With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. As we celebrate the Day of the Dead here at Savage Science Radio, how about a little mood music as you slip into the world of shadows?
Please bring me my
going to tell you a little bit of a story about indigenous people. Indigenous people who wouldn't let the Day of the Dead die. More than 500 years ago, when the Spanish conquistadors landed in what is now known as Mexico, they encountered natives practicing a ritual that seemed to mock death. Well, to them, that's what it seemed like. It was a ritual the indigenous people had been practicing at least 3,000 years prior to their arrival, and it's also a ritual that the Spaniards would try unsuccessfully to eradicate. This ritual is known today as Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead. The ritual is celebrated in Mexico and certain parts of the United States, including the Valley. Celebrations are held each year in Mesa, Chandler, Guadalupe, and at Arizona State University, for example. Huge processions and celebrations that you can look up on YouTube, and you can see some of the goings-ons if you are not in that vicinity. Although the ritual has since been merged with Catholic theology, it still maintains the basic principles of the Aztec ritual, and one of those items that's used in the ritual are skulls. Yes, craniums. Now, today, people don wooden skull masks called calacas, and they dance in honor of their deceased relatives. The wooden skulls are placed on altars that are dedicated to the dead. Now, sugar skulls, something different, made with the names of the dead person on the forehead, are eaten by a relative or a friend, according to Mary J. Andrade, who has written about 3 books on the ritual, and there's also recipes in there on how to make them. So if you want to try that out, that's kind of neat to honor people that have passed that were important to you. Now, the Aztecs and other Mesoamerican civilizations kept skulls as trophies and displayed them during the ritual, which is not uncommon in many cultures. The skulls were used to symbolize death and rebirth. The skulls were also used to honor the dead, whom the Aztecs and other Mesoamerican civilizations believed came back to visit during the month-long ritual. Yes, a month-long ritual. Month-long celebration. Fiesta. Fandango. Unlike the Spaniards, who viewed death as the end of life, the natives viewed it as a continuation of life. Instead of fearing death, they embraced it. And to them, life was a dream, and only in death did they truly become awake. Now, the pre-Hispanic people honored duality as being dynamic, said Christina Gonzalez, senior lecturer on Hispanic issues at Arizona State University. And they didn't separate death from pain, wealth from poverty, like they did in Western cultures. However, the Spaniards considered the ritual to be sacrilegious. They perceived the indigenous people to be barbaric and pagan. And pagan would be anything that's not, you know, Christian or basically Catholic, because Catholic is the beginning of Christianity as far as a ritualistic organized religion. But like the old Aztec spirits, the ritual refused to die. To make the ritual more Christian, the Spaniards moved it so it coincided with All Saints Day and All Souls Day, which is November 1st and 2nd. Originally it was in May, but let's not go there. Now, it's in November, and it's celebrated that way today. So, previously, it fell in the 9th month of the Aztec solar calendar, approximately the beginning of August, and that was before the Catholics got a hold of it. And it was celebrated for the entire month. Festivities were presided over by the goddess, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that name. And the goddess was known as the Lady of the Dead. That's all you need to know. And was believed to have died at birth, Andrade said. And today, the Day of the Dead is celebrated in Mexico and certain parts of the United States and Central America. It's celebrated differently, depending on where you go, Gonzalez said. In rural Mexico, people visit the cemetery where their loved ones are buried. They decorate gravesites with marigold flowers and candles. They bring toys for dead children and bottles of tequila to the adults. They sit on picnic blankets next to the gravestones and gravesites and eat their favorite food of their loved ones. In Guadalupe, the ritual is celebrated much like it is in rural Mexico. Here, the people spend the day in the cemetery, says Esther Coda, the parish secretary at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. And she adds that the graves are decorated very prettily by the people. In Mesa, the ritual has evolved to include other cultures, said Zarco Guerrero, a Mesa artist. Last year, he says, we had Native Americans and African Americans doing their own dances. They all want the opportunity to honor their dead. Now, in the United States and in Mexico's larger cities, families build altars in their homes, dedicating them to the dead. They surround these altars with flowers, food, and pictures of the deceased. They light candles and place them next to the altar. We honor them by transforming the room into an altar, Guerrero said. We offer incense, flowers, we play their favorite music, and make their favorite food. At Guerrero's house, the altar is not only dedicated to friends and family members who have died, but to others as well. Quote, we pay homage to the Mexicans killed in auto accidents while being smuggled across the border, he said. And more recently, we've been honoring the memories of those killed in Columbine, for example. So, as you can see, this is not just a celebration of the dead, but it's a celebration of their lives by the living. It's much less morbid than previously thought by the Western eyes that first encountered it, and it's a tradition that they embraced and celebrate still to this day. So if you'd like to ever take a little bit in of this ever-expanding tradition, you can take a look at YouTube and see some of the wonderful festivities. Olvera Street is one place that you can look up, and boy, is that something to behold, and the food, oh, the food. If you're ever out this way, you have to check it out. Known as the Lady of the Dead, that's all you need to know, and was believed to have died at birth, Andrade said. And today, the Day of the Dead is celebrated in Mexico and certain parts of the United States and Central America. It's celebrated differently, depending on where you go, Gonzalez said. In rural Mexico, people visit the cemetery where their loved ones are buried. They decorate grave sites with marigold flowers and candles. They bring toys for dead children and bottles of tequila to the adults. They sit on picnic blankets next to the gravestones and grave sites and eat their favorite food of their loved ones. In Guadalupe, the ritual is celebrated much like it is in rural Mexico. Here, the people spend the day in the cemetery, says Esther Coda, the parish secretary at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church. And she adds that the graves are decorated very prettily by the people. In Mesa, the ritual has evolved to include other cultures, said Zarco Guerrero, a Mesa artist. Last year, he says, we had Native Americans and African Americans doing their own dances. They all want the opportunity to honor their dead. Now, in the United States and in Mexico's larger cities, families build altars in their homes, dedicating them to the dead. They surround these altars with flowers, food, and pictures of the deceased. They light candles and place them next to the altar. We honor them by transforming the room into an altar, Guerrero said. We offer incense, flowers, we play their favorite music, and make their favorite food. At Guerrero's house, the altar is not only dedicated to friends and family members who have died, but to others as well. Quote, we pay homage to the Mexicans killed in auto accidents while being smuggled across the border, he said. And more recently, we've been honoring the memories of those killed in Columbine, for example. So, as you can see, this is not just a celebration of the dead, but it's a celebration of their lives by the living. It's much less morbid than previously thought by the Western eyes that first encountered it, and it's a tradition that they embraced and celebrate still to this day. So if you'd like to ever take a little bit in of this ever-expanding tradition, you can take a look at YouTube and see some of the wonderful festivities. Olvera Street is one place that you can look up, and boy, is that something to behold, and the food, oh, the food. If you're ever out this way, you have to check it out.
Radio 4, Ray Bradbury's Tales of the Bizarre. Tonight's story is called The Scythe, and Ray Bradbury's here to tell us a little of the background to his story.
Several elements in my childhood. I was always curious about the reapers out in the fields during the harvest, some of them actually with old-fashioned scythes, not very far from my hometown. At the same time, I saw illustrations in the Sunday papers of the grim reaper with his scythe, reaping souls all over the world. These elements came together, and I put them into this story to see what would happen. That's often what occurs with me. I get an idea, and I let it write itself. 2 hours after I began the story, it was finished, and so we have the scythe.
What a goddamn life.
True, the kids.
For pity's sake, Molly, you gonna try and keep them from discovering that they're living in a stinking pit of a world?
If I can.
And how? Forgive my asking, but how? We scrimp and save and somehow haul ourselves out of that no-hope city, buy us a few measly acres of land, thinking we might be able to scratch together some sort of living where at least the air didn't reek of death.
True.
And what happens? Farm is blown clean out from under us by some mean, greedy wind that'll only eat good earth.
I know.
Now we're almost clean out of gas and miles from anywhere.
Must have taken a wrong fork back yonder.
You're pretty damn wrong, I'd say. One minute you're on a road that's running down a valley like any other regular road, and all of a sudden, it ain't going nowhere.
Hardly nowhere, Drew. There's a farmhouse over there and a wheat field growing alongside. Looks like a good crop, too.
Yeah? Well, what's a good crop doing growing out here in this wilderness land?
Oh.
Well, that's it. Just as we run out of gas, we run out of road.
Pa, what are we stopping for?
Are we gonna eat now, Pa? You sure awful hungry.
Can we eat, Pa? Can we?
Susie, Walt, you two hush up now, do you hear?
What am I to say to him, Molly? You tell me you have all the goddamn answers. Tell me how to tell my kids I ain't got no food and no money and no way of getting either.
Drew, maybe in the house there.
What?
Well, maybe they could spare us something to eat.
Begging? Do you mean go begging?
Drew, listen to me. The kids...
Okay. Okay.
Door's open.
Can't just walk into folks' homes.
But it's so hot out here, and those kids will be frying in the car. I'm going in, Drew.
Oh.
Not much of a place, but it's real clean. It's like someone's just gone around and tidied up.
Yeah. Hello? Hello? Hello?
What? What is it?
In there. The bedroom on the bed.
Huh? Is he...
Better see.
Oh. He's dead, isn't he?
Not long since.
He's old.
Must have known he was going to die and laid himself out.
Maybe knew there was no one else to do it for him.
And put on his own grave clothes. Brushed up his old black suit and found himself a clean white shirt and a black tie. And then just laid him down and waited to die.
With a blade of wheat in his hands?
All ripe and golden and heavy. And still fresh. Guess that's his scythe propped up against a wall.
But why would you...
There's something's on the pillow there. Beside his head, a scrap of paper.
Drew, leave it. We shouldn't be here.
We are here, Molly. To him who stands beside me at my deathbed, being of sound mind and alone in the world, as it has been decreed, I, John Burr, do give and bequeath this farm
with all pertaining to it, to the man who is to come. Whatever his name or origin should be, it will not matter. The farm is his, and the wheat, the scythe, and the task ordained thereto. Let him take them freely and without question, and remember that I, John Burr, am only the giver, not the ordainer. To which I set my hand and seal this third day of August, 938. John Burr, Kyrie eleison.
What was that last bit?
Kyrie eleison. Ain't that Lord have mercy?
But why that? Why those words?
Maybe he was a religious man.
So we inherit this farm, right?
Seems that way.
It's too good to be true. There must be some trick to it.
Our luck's changing, that's all. Look, we have work to do, stuff to eat, something over our heads to keep the rain off.
Yeah, okay. But we don't have to keep the scythe in the bedroom, right?
Right. Sure. Yeah. Beautiful craftsmanship. Gleams like a great big wide gleaming smile.
Words?
Who wheels me, wheels the world.
Who wheels me, wheels the world.
Drew.
What?
The old man. Why? Why is he holding that wheat stalk so hard in his fingers?
Lord, well, this here's the body of John Burr, who gave us this farm for ourselves. We put him up here on top of this hill under this old tree so he can look down, as it were, on that farmhouse where he used to live and those fields where he used to work. The thing is, Lord, we didn't properly know John Burr. In fact, all we know about him is his ending. But you knew him. You knew what kind of man he was, and you know what you want to do with his soul. But we just pay our respects to him and we'll leave the rest to you. That's it, I guess. Amen.
Amen.
Except, Kyrie eleison. Molly! Molly, come look in here!
I was in the kitchen getting some food. There's stacks of stuff.
Yeah, plenty more here, too. See, sides of beef and bacon, pork, mutton. Yeah, I reckon there's more than enough here to feed a family five times our size for a year. 2 years, maybe three. Hey, there's a churn and cheeses over there. And fresh milk on tap.
Oh, there'll be such a meal on the table tonight. And after you've eaten your fill, you can sit on the porch and smoke a cigar.
A what?
A cigar! There's a whole box of them. A box, Drew. For you to have a long, lingering smoke at the end of the day when you're done working.
Then I damn well better do some work. I better take that side and cut some grain. God, but this is a big field. Well...
Wheels me. Wheels me.
Too big. This field's got a stretch all of 3 miles to those mountains. And it must be, I don't know, 2 miles wide. That's just too big for one man to tend. And yet, one man tended it. And so must I. God knows why, except somehow it seems important. Very, very important.
Wheels me. Wheels me. wields the world.
Ruth! Ruth! Dinner!
I don't understand. Makes no sort of sense. Whoever heard of a wheat field that ripens only in separate clumps of wheat that are some way off from each other? Why should it do that? Wheat shouldn't do that. Doesn't do that. Ever.
Ruth! Ruth!
What's more, wheat doesn't rot just a few hours after you've cut it. What good's that to me? Can't sell it, can't use it.
Ruth!
Anyway, got plenty of food at the moment. Shouldn't worry, perhaps. Think it over. Work it out. Gotta be some sort of answer. John Burr? Can you hear me down there in the good black soil?
I am only the giver, not the ordainer.
What did you mean? Who is the ordainer, huh? And what exactly have you bequeathed me?
The farm and the wheat.
And what is it about this wheat? This damn great field of wheat.
The wheat, the sign, and the task ordained thereto.
Do you know, I honestly believe if I were to cut the wheat for the next 10 years, just as it ripens up, I don't think I'd pass the same spot twice. So what happens if I don't carry out the task? If I don't wield the scythe? What happens then? Well, maybe we'll see. What the hell is this all about? I'm churning milk into butter in the cool ball, and in the sun's in my head burning and itching.
A task ordained.
I'm sitting on the porch, and my fingers jump and grip the empty air, burning and aching.
A task ordained.
I'm lying in bed, and my arms are aching like something's been cut off but still throbbing.
A task.
This goddamn task! I can't pass this field without looking and staring and watching how the wind bends and tips and stirs the ripe, beautiful wheat that is aching. Aching to be cut. Damn it to hell. All right. The task ordained. The wheat will be cut. I'll fetch the scythe. Who wields me each day? Wields me every day. Wields the world. Cut the grain.
The task ordained.
Think about the old man, the wheat in his hands when he died. No. Up, down. Think about this dead land with wheat living on it. No. Up, down. Think about the way it grows. Crazy patterns. Ripe wheat. Green wheat. No.
No. No.
Up, down. Think. No. Is it? No. No. No, it can't be. How can I have killed her? And all these others. I've killed so many.
Molly! Molly!
Drew! Hey! What is it?
Oh, Molly! Oh, God!
Drew, what is it? Tell me.
Get the things packed.
Why?
We're leaving.
We're leaving?
That old man. You know what he did here? It's the wheat, Molly. And this scythe.
Who wields me? Wields
the world. Every time you use the scythe on the wheat, 1,000 people die. You cut across.
Honey, listen to me. We traveled a lot and haven't eaten good until the last month here, and you've been working every day, and you're tired.
Molly, I hear voices. Sad voices out there in the wheat telling me to stop, telling me not to kill him.
Drew.
Oh, God. Molly, help me. I just killed my mother.
Stop it.
I cut down one stalk of wheat and I killed her.
I felt her dying. That's how I found out just now.
Drew, shut up.
Oh,
10 years I've been with you. And sometimes we had nothing but dust and prayers in our mouths. And now all this good luck sudden and you can't bear up under it.
I'm sorry.
This life is so different. It's gonna take time. I'll give it a few weeks more. Everything will be fine. You'll see. There's a good girl. You're back from town mighty quick, Drew. I mean, it's a long way.
Molly, we gotta talk.
Okay, I'm listening.
I went to the store to see if there was any general delivery mail for us. There was a letter from Sis answering mine.
Good.
Mother passed away. 1:00 Tuesday afternoon. Her heart.
Drew, I'm so sorry.
Get the kids in the
honey.
Car loaded up with food. We're going on to California.
Drew.
You know yourself this is poor grain land. Yet look how ripe it grows out there. Now, I ain't told you all the things. It ripens in patches. A little each day, it ain't right. And when I cut it, it rots. And next morning, it comes up again without any help growing again.
We're staying here.
Oh, Molly.
We are staying here. Where we're sure of eating and sleeping and living decent and living long. I'm not starving my children down again. Ever.
John Burr, I've come back again, and I'll keep coming back here to your grave hoping for some sort of answer.
I am only the giver.
If you won't tell me, let me tell you. You work the field all your life because you had to. Am I right?
Only the giver.
And then... Christ, there's your answer. A little single sprout of wheat growing right there in the center of your grave. Where did that come from? From the wheat stalk you were holding in your hands a few weeks ago. That same sprout, reborn.
The wheat, the scythe, the task ordained.
One day when you were working in the field, you came across your own life growing there. You cut it, and you went home, put on your grave clothes, and your heart gave out, and you died. That's how it was, wasn't it? And you passed the land on to me, and when I die, I'm supposed to hand it on to someone else. How long a time has this been going on? With nobody knowing about this field and its use except the man with the scythe.
Only the giver. Not the ordainer.
I must go to work.
Kyrie eleison.
Swing up, swing down.
Damn. Wields me. Wields the world.
I'm the wielder of the scythe. Me, Drew Erickson. Wielder of the scythe, who wields me, wields the world. Swing up, swing down, up, down. The wheat, the scythe, the task ordained, mine. My way of getting food and
housing for the family after all these years. So up, swing down. Up, down. Swing up. Oh, my God. There they are. Right there in the wheat. Susie, Walt, it's all right. Now that I've found you all, now that I know you're all out here, I know what I have to do.
Drew, you made me jump. You quit early today.
Yeah, today and for good.
What? And what are you doing with that thing in the house?
I'm locking this goddamn side in the cellar. And that's where it's going to stay. I'm going to put the key away where no one but me can ever find it. All right?
But, honey, why?
What's more, I got to stay here all my life. So long as I live. Because I'm damned if I'm handing this field over to some stranger to cut, and that's that.
True.
Nobody's ever going to cut that wheat field again. Understand me, Molly? Nobody, never. Not me, not nobody.
Honey, about the field.
What about it?
So many weeks since you stopped going out there, since you locked up the side, that it needs cutting. You do know that, don't you, Drew? Parts of it need cutting now.
Wheels me. Wheels the world.
What'll happen to the world if you never go back into that field?
Molly?
Yeah?
Nothing.
Turn out the lamp.
Doing out here in the middle of the night? I don't want to come back here. I know there's people out there ripe for death, but I don't want to kill anymore. If I work with the scythe, I'll have to kill Molly and the kids. Oh, don't ask me to do that. Christ, what's that? Oh no, the house. Oh no, Molly, Walt, Susie. Gone. All gone. Nothing. Nothing left. Molly. Molly, I love you so much. Molly? Molly? You're here. You're here. Molly, you're not dead. I don't understand. Molly, wake up. Wake up! Come on! What's the matter with you? No! I don't believe it! Oh, Christ! The kids! The kids! Oh, God! Thank you, God! Kids! Susie! Walt! Molly! The kids! They're all right! Kids! Wake up! Wake up! Oh, wait. Oh, what? Why won't you wake up? Of course. The wheat, the scythe, the task ordained. You should have died yesterday in the fire. Now the house is gone and you're not dead. Not alive. Oh, wheels me.
wheels the world.
And all over the world, thousands of others, victims of fires, accidents, illnesses, diseases, waiting, not able to live, not able to die, all because of me. Thinking I could stop working with the side. Oh, Molly, my dear one. Susie, Walt, oh, please forgive me. Forgive me for what I have done and for what I must do now. All right, then. I'll use the scythe. I'll use it and I'll stop for no one. Who wields me, wields the world. Well, I shall wield the scythe. I'll swing and cut and slash and hack, and I won't ever stop. Molly, Susie, Walt. If the field needs harvesting, I shall harvest it. Every single standing stalk of it, however it grows, ready or not to meet the blade, I shall harvest it all, the ripe and the green. Listen, world! Wake up! Wake up and tremble! I curse you! It is harvest time, and I am the harvester, goddamn reaper of death. Kyrie eleison!
The Scythe is perhaps one of my darker stories. In The Scythe, Drew was played by John Garazio, Molly by Brianne Glasgow, and John Burr by Hugh Dixon. Susie was played by Barbara Barnes, and Walt by Barclay Wright. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The Scythe was written by me, Ray Bradbury, and the radio adaptation was the work of Brian Sibley, and that script was directed in London by Tabitha Potts. Next week's story is also about country matters. That ever-present companion in the country, in the rustling leaves and bending grasses, is the wind. Do join me for that, my next tale of the bizarre.
And now, in the effort to bring you the other side of the coin, scientists want to know if you want to see a specter badly enough, will you? Well, researchers set up a haunted room to prove an electromagnetic theory of ghost sightings. You might be familiar with Michael Persinger. He has studied the potential role that electromagnetic fields and infrasound may play in causing the perception that something is haunted. Of course, you might be familiar with his work already with the God Helmet, and I believe Richard Dawkins was involved with that in some capacity. They were able to recreate through electromagnetic pulses in a helmet that was placed on people's head, spiritual experiences. So, wow, that was pretty exciting. You can, like I said, look that up. But this is about ghosts, specifically, and paranormal experiences. So most scientists dismiss the vast majority, as you know, of ghost sightings as hoaxes. of course, but researchers in Canada, England, and elsewhere are exploring what happens in the brain to create the illusion that something is haunted. So far, they have found evidence that some apparitions may be brain benders by caused by spiking EMFs, which are electromagnetic fields, and possibly even low-frequency sound waves known as infrasound. It's so subtle that the ear does not even register them as noise, believe it or not. Now, EMFs are emitted by power lines and towers, clock radios, and other electrical sources, and they may help debunk myths that people or things are haunted, says Michael Persinger. And he is a neuroscientist, by the way, at Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada, which is where those God helmet experiments were conducted. And one such study published in 2001 in Perceptual and Motor Skills chronicles the experiences of a teenager who in 1996 claimed to be receiving nocturnal visits, rated R, from none other than the Holy Spirit. The 17-year-old girl, who had sustained mild brain damage at birth, said she also felt the presence of an invisible baby perched on her left shoulder. Now, when Persinger and his colleagues investigated at the behest of the girl's mother, of course, they found an electric clock next to the bed that was about 10 inches or so, or 25.4 centimeters if you're not in America, everywhere else in the world, from where she placed her head when she slept. Tests showed that the clock generated electromagnetic pulses with waveforms similar to those found to trigger epileptic seizures in rats and in humans. When the clock was removed, the visions stopped. Persinger determined that the clock, in combination with the girl's brain injury, were likely to have been contributing factors to the perceived nocturnal visits. Although Persinger believes this case and others offer compelling evidence that EMFs contribute to a person's perception that something is haunted, experiments intended to prove this theory leave room for doubt. Yes, exactly. It didn't prove it. Christopher French is a psychologist at Goldsmiths University of London College in London, who studies the paranormal, is one researcher who has conducted experiments to test the EMF theory, and he's been unable to prove its validity also. He and his colleagues 4 years ago built a haunted room in a London apartment rigged with electromagnetic sources and infrasound generators. They invited 79 volunteers recruited via the internet, of course, and they asked them to spend some time inside the cool, dimly lit space. Researchers disclosed to the subjects that they might experience some weirdness, feel a presence, tingling, or other strange sensation while in the room, and were given psychological evaluations to assess their susceptibility to the suggestion of the paranormal. This included the Australian sheep-goat scale that it's the one that tries to separate likely believers, which are sheep, from skeptics, which are goats. Now, examples of items on the scale include questions about belief in life after death and whether a subject has ever experienced an episode of precognition, which is, you know, telling the future, or like an event that you foresee, I guess. Now, the researchers used a computer to drive twin coils hidden behind the walls of the room that generated EMF pulses up to 50 microteslas, and which is a unit of strength, a unit of measuring the strength of a magnetic field. And these were, of course, of the electromagnetic pulses, many times greater than the 1 to 4 microteslas generated by Persinger's clock that we were talking about a minute ago. They also used a computer to pump in extremely low-frequency infrasound waves that were well below what humans could possibly hear. Such sounds have been linked, albeit tenuously, to some alleged hauntings. In a 1998 Journal for the Society of Psychical Research, yes, I said psychical research, article entitled "The Ghost in the Machine," Coventry University, UK in England, researchers Vic Tandy and Tony Lawrence describe an experiment during which they detected an infrasound wave with a frequency of 18.9 hertz in a factory where workers had reported strange experiences they believed to be paranormal. French and his team used waveforms of 18.9 and 22.3 hertz, by the way. Now, French's volunteers were exposed to electromagnetic pulses, infrasound, both, or neither. Most people reported at least some slightly odd sensations, such as a presence or feeling dizzy, and some reported terror, which they hadn't expected. French says, terror is obviously quite an extreme reaction, and we only anticipated getting reports of mildly anomalous sensations in the context of this particular experiment, unquote. Still, French and his colleagues could not conclude that EMFs played a role in conjuring these feelings. Like any dutiful researcher, French, who became interested in paranormal psychology after reading the 1981 book Parapsychology, Science, or Magic, by the renowned doubter and British psychologist James E. Alcock, which you can look up, very cool, has gone into the field visiting purportedly haunted houses, which are ample supply in England, as you probably know. As a matter of fact, I believe there was a study, or at least a poll, that showed that more people in England believe in ghosts than in religion. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I think some of us put them on the same par level, but okay. He says believers psych each other up, sitting in pitch darkness where you hear noises, which are common in these old houses, but believers see and hear things that just aren't there, according to our recording devices. French's findings were published in the journal Cortex, I believe that was October 2008, and he and his colleagues have been trying to garner funding for a follow-up study. It will not be easy poking holes in ghost stories that might appear on its face to be of little scientific value. Still, French insists that research can reveal important truths about the human mind, including questions of memory and delusions. Within psychology, people talk about reality monitoring, trying to understand how we make distinctions between mental events and events that take place out there in the real world. It's like something that we take for granted. Did you really lock the door before you went to bed, or did you just think about it? On the extreme is schizophrenia, in which the brain makes no distinction between the real and the imagined. Of course, we have to make sure we can differentiate between the two. There's a continuum, and this kind of framework is useful when you're talking about hallucinatory experiences. People are mistaking their attribution, feeling a product of their own mental processes, or something that's taking place in the real world. He says anything that can lead to making your mental events more similar to events that take place, a vivid imagination, for example, will make it more difficult to distinguish between the two. Now, of course, believers say French cannot see or hear ghosts because he is a horrible skeptic, which he readily admits. I wish it was a bit more spooky, he says of his time waiting for apparitions to appear in the dank, musty castles. I'm sitting in the dark, in the cold. I wish something more would happen, he says. Boy, if you've ever been on one of those ghost hunts, exactly. Ditto. Persinger commends French's team on its splendid experiment, even if it didn't validate his ideas. Still, he contends EMFs do affect the body in many ways, from the brain to individual cells to enzymes and even DNA. The key to testing their effects on brain activity, he says, is to make sure that the fields are neither too strong nor too weak and that they come in the right pattern. So he is not willing to give up the ghost on finding a way to prove scientifically that EMFs are behind at least some ghost sightings. I'm a scientist, Persinger says. I don't believe in anything. So, while we have people who are alive honoring the lives of the dead, people playing with the dead, and then people looking to see if the dead are just actual figments of our imagination created by electromagnetic fields and infrasound environments, I guess the jury's still out. I'll let you decide on that. And it's about time for Savage Science Radio to sign off for this week. I'd like to thank Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for the fantastic show intro that we use every week, Nick Piloco for the beautiful show graphics, and Todd Sheets, the magic man behind the technical controls here at Savage Science Radio. For the next week, have a wonderful time. Keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails until we meet again.
All our times have come here, but now they're
win the sun.